This Sunday, the city we know and love, Detroit, is turning 321 years old. Still looks pretty good, though. There's a free event at Beacon Park to mark the occasion. But on Culture Shift, it made us think about Detroit before the French named it that. Who was here? What was it like? And are there any traces of the city's indigenous past still able to be seen or felt in the city today? To have this conversation, we're joined by Wayne State University Associate Professor Karen Marrero, author of Detroit's Hidden Channels, The Power of French Indigenous Families in the 18th Century. She researches, writes, and teaches early North American and Indigenous history. Karen, thank you so much for joining us on Culture Shift.
Thank you so much for having me and inviting me to be with you today.
I really love this opportunity to use Detroit's birthday to look way back in time, to really go to the origins of this place and what it was like before we even knew it as Detroit. And the first thing that kept popping into my head, Karen, was, is there anything still in the city today that we can see that's part of the indigenous history of this place?
A lot of what was indigenous was erased, as I think we all know, by the settler presence, particularly as the 19th century sort of unfolded. And so a lot of that presence has gone underground. Tribal communities now in Detroit maintain their own memories or family stories that connect them to the landscape, and those are sort of oral histories that they maintain within their nations. But for the rest of us, for everybody else, there isn't much left. There is one mound, much smaller than the size it had originally been at a historic Fort Wayne in southwest Detroit. That remains. But there were a lot more mounds at the turn of the 19th century, which sort of was evidence of a very thriving Native presence. So that's about it.
And when we think about that, when we really go broad with it, if we look around the country, are there, you know, other places that have done a better job of trying to preserve those spaces? Or is Detroit a good example of the lack of preserving these spaces?
It's a national trend. And definitely, where, you know, there was an effort, sometimes very concerted effort, to sort of wipe out indigenous spaces, tribal community land holdings that were sort of held in common to sort of force indigenous people to hold land privately. This really happened in the course of the 19th century. So it's a general trend, unfortunately, that happened across the nation. Efforts to sort of call back some of that history is also something that's happening across the nation in different places. So in Michigan right now, from what I understand, the state, the Michigan History Center, is making a great effort to try to do that as well, including addressing the lack of historical markers, right, that designate spaces that were important to indigenous people in their history. So we're starting. It's starting. And across the river in Windsor, they've got a bit of a head start over us. But we all have a long way to go to sort of bring back some of that history.
You mentioned, you know, oral histories being so critical to tribes to be able to relate this history verbally to one another. I'm curious, you know, what are the ways beyond markers? You mentioned, you know, Windsor getting a head start. What are some of the ways that different cities, municipalities are trying to make this right or try to remember this history?
Well, you know, what people are trying to do, for example, a lot of our major highways across the state, and again, this is the case across the country, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, roadways like I-94 started life as indigenous roadways, right? And there's been an effort within this state and other states to sort of go back to that history and understand, you know, what these roadways were, who used them, what they connected. So I see some of that is going on in the state. It sort of forces municipalities to work together. So I think, smaller towns and cities are starting this work within the confines of their municipalities right now. But it will require reaching out, right? Which I think is a good thing to reconnect people to this history.
You mentioned I-94 having indigenous roots. You know, that's another thing I think about whenever I'm in New York, when you think of Broadway cutting across Manhattan. And the reason it does that is because it still honors the trail that was there previously. Yep. Woodward was also a pathway, correct?
Yes. It was Saginaw Trail. And there's been a lot of good work, and historians and other local scholars who are starting to delve into this particular history, so we understand the connection that the lower part of the state had to the middle part in the Upper Peninsula as native spaces. So Saginaw Trail is a really good example of that.
So a little bit of that history, at least we can know that and talk about that and understand that. And that's a big reason why you're here today. You know, if we're thinking about the Saginaw Trail, can you set the scene of how that would work, what that would look like before Detroit had its roots here?
A good place to think about, to try and drastically sort of reorient yourself physically in this landscape is to think about the fact that well into the early part of the 19th century, past about a mile back from the Detroit River, it was forest, right? It was not, you would not have been able to sort of penetrate that area. And so people would have been traveling by waterways. And indigenous people had been doing that for centuries before, for example, Europeans like the French that have showed up here. You really had to travel by water in order to get across the landscape. So trails that were maintained or carved out, like the Saginaw Trail, were vitally important. For example, there would be conferences held in places like Detroit late in the 18th century. And there would be indigenous nations coming from places like Mackinac, and places farther north on Lake Superior, all part of Anishinaabe territory. There were Cherokee people visiting to be part of these councils, and they were taking paths, including one called the Great Warrior Path, that went all the way south from Detroit. So if we think about all of those things, the landscape looks just drastically different than what we imagine it today. And people moved across it in a very different way too. So it's a difficult history to try and reconnect to. But when we think in this way, it sort of changes our orientation to the landscape.
It really makes me wonder about the power of VR in relation to this. Being able to try to be somewhere, stand somewhere, and use technology to put yourself to what it actually would look like. Have you heard of anything like that happening?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of that. That doesn't mean it's not happening because I'm not aware of it. But I do know of scholars. There was a scholar I know of who was working on mapping crooked trees, which were deliberately sort of physically manipulated by Anishinaabe people, for example, here and mostly farther north than here, which acted as guides across the landscape, right? Like you saw a particular crooked tree that was bent, its branches bent a certain way, and it was really a marker that told you where to go and how to go. So there's been efforts to understand the landscape from that particular perspective. And again, I'm definitely not an expert in this. I just know about some of the work other people are doing. So the VR question is a good one. There's probably people out there who know a lot more about it than I do.
I'm just imagining what we're capable of moving forward to try to take us back and try to understand these landscapes. And Karen, let's go 101 on this. All right. So, I mean, if we're talking about pre-Detroit, can you really set a scene, give us a primer of who was here and why this place was selected as a place to have indigenous cultures settle here?
Well, it was a very, you know, if we look at, you know, another sort of clue to what this landscape looked like or, you know, why people settled here are some of the, you know, native names for this area. And a lot of your listeners may know that the Anishinaabe name for Detroit is Wewetonong, which means Crooked Way, which is a reference to the Detroit River. And a lot of the names, you know, French names, English names that come later are sort of variations of the original native names, right? Wyandotte name for Detroit is, and pardon my pronunciation, Carantuan, which means coast of the straits. And we recognize, you know, Detroit, the strait, comes from, it wasn't sort of a word that was invented whole cloth. It comes from a landscape that when the French arrived here in 1701, that was already sort of vibrant, peopled by thousands of indigenous people, many different nations. So Detroit was a place that people moved through. It connected all of these waterways. And this is why Europeans were interested in sort of establishing a base here, because they got this knowledge, they understood this from having interacted with indigenous people and found out the optimal places that they could locate their forts. So for the French, for example, who were establishing themselves on the St. Lawrence Seaway in what is now Quebec City and Montreal and areas around there, they were interested in sort of making use of, or, you know, getting into the fur trade, trading in fur pelts, making money that way. And so they sort of made their way to the interior of the continent by rivers. As I mentioned earlier, it really was the only way that people could get around across this landscape. So, you know, that particular sort of set of waterways took them all the way from Quebec, St. Lawrence Seaway, all the way through to Detroit and Mackinac through the Great Lakes. And from there, they continued to places like Fort Wayne and went south all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and to New Orleans. So you could do that entirely by traveling by water and portaging. And again, they learned about this through indigenous people. So Detroit was known as a place, a meeting place, a place, as I mentioned before, a place people moved through that connected people across the continent. So we have, for example, in European records or French records, there had been a series of wars taking place at the end of the 17th century across the Great Lakes. That involved different indigenous nations, and the French got involved in and the English got involved in. And that war and the fact that it sort of displaced so many people made it very difficult, if not impossible, for the to settle. So there was what is called the Great Peace of Montreal, which was a huge diplomatic meeting held in Montreal in the summer of 1701. If not for that meeting, Detroit would not have been able to be settled because there were many hundred indigenous diplomats who traveled from across the Great Lakes, the Detroit, farther north, even from southern nations, who traveled to Montreal to meet with French representatives. And they signed a great document, La Paix de Montréal, or the Peace of Montreal. And there are records of this document, and they're signed by indigenous diplomats with their dudems or their totems, representing their clan animals. And they allowed the French to travel to places like Detroit and establish forts. So we have reference to Detroit in some of those documents, and historians have, not just me, but other historians have done a lot of work looking at this document and understanding what it says about what Detroit looked like and why it was important and special. It was referred to in those documents as a common bowl. And again, there's been great work done by indigenous historians and non-indigenous historians on the meaning of that concept. So a common bowl was a sort of a location or a place, and Detroit was really one of only two places that's designated in this way, where different groups of people or different indigenous nations sort of were able to come here and to share resources together. So it truly is a place of sharing, a place where nobody could make a claim that completely obliterated the claims of other people to access those resources. So Detroit's this, like I said, this in-between place, this place that people move through, hunting territory. So this is why there's something so special about Detroit even to today.
Yeah, you've done quite a bit of research to the sort of political power of Detroit at that time, and the understanding that, you know, what happened here would resonate through the Great Lakes and through those channels. So yes, both the French and indigenous cultures really understood that power, and at least for a time, you make it sound like it was a very collaborative space, but that didn't stay that way.
No, it didn't stay that way. You know, it had been prior to, mostly for the most part, prior to the arrival of the French. But, you know, we have, once the French arrived, and, you know, I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about Cadillac. We've already talked so much about him for centuries now. But Cadillac had been in charge up at Michilimackinac. So he knew about, again, through indigenous informants, and he doesn't say he learned that knowledge from indigenous informants. You know, in official correspondence, he's sending back and forth with his superiors. So he's sort of saying, I know all of these things, but he doesn't say how he knows. But he had these, you know, sort of ideas about sort of setting himself up as a seigneur, you know, sort of as a like a landlord, and sort of setting up a little empire at Detroit. He thought he had Native people where he wanted them, right? That they would sort of ally with him or work together with him, stay true to the French cause or at least to his cause. But he misrepresented and simplified what was going on here, right? The sort of complex sort of cultural and political and economic situation that already existed here in Detroit as an indigenous space. So it wasn't long before we get wars breaking out. And in French records, these are referred to or in scholarship as the Fox Wars, which broke out in the second decade of the 18th century. And they started at Detroit. A lot of this, again, we can talk about Detroit as a special place because a lot of these wars or these misunderstandings sort of break out here and then spread across the Great Lakes and end up involving a lot of indigenous and non-indigenous people. And the Fox Wars, which named for the Fox or Meskwaki Nation, started here because Cadillac was sort of trying to gather a bunch of indigenous nations here, sort of each give everybody sort of their own sort of parcel of land and have everybody live happily together, all to sort of further his economic aims. And of course, it didn't work out that way. So early in the French presence, this experiment, Cadillac's experiment, really went awry.
And you mentioned We've talked plenty about Cadillac. Are you seeing a movement with historians to, I don't want to say right those wrongs, but try to avoid mischaracterizing history through some of these bad actors?
Yes. yes, that's, you know, and I'm sure this, you know, this is sort of a movement that's been afoot now for quite a while. I'm sure it doesn't come as a surprise to a lot of your listeners that we're trying to, first of all, understand, if we really truly want to understand Detroit historically as a space, right? It has a history, a long history that predates the arrival of Cadillac. Detroit is not just Cadillac. And actually understanding that we need to sort of complicate that history and try to understand it, and people are doing this work now, it makes for a richer, more interesting history. Much, much more interesting than just one man arriving here and saying, okay, you know, it's July 24th, I'm going to build my church, and, you know, and it all begins. The true history, the real history, is much richer and goes back a lot farther than that. So, you know, when we talk about these sort of anniversaries, you know, there are good and bad things about them, as we understand. But as long as we understand that it marks one sort of ripple in time or one ripple in Detroit's history, and use that as a way to make us aware that there's so much more, and to start looking around and doing that work or reading the work of historians and scholars, indigenous and non-indigenous, who are trying to bring back that richer history. So it's a reminder. To me, the anniversary, this July 24, 1701, is a reminder to be mindful about that.
That is Wayne State University Associate Professor Karen Marrero, researches and teaches early North American and Indigenous history, also the author of Detroit's Hidden Channels, The Power of French Indigenous Families in the 18th Century. Karen joined us to mark Detroit's birthday, but really look beyond that and deeper into the history. And Karen, we really appreciate you taking the time and doing just that for us here on Culture Shift.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to be with you today. Thanks very much.